And the new Interior Secretary yesterday has canceled some deals. That would be dozens of oil and gas leases in Utah that the Bush administration sold to energy companies just before Mr. Bush left office. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has more.
210, you want a bit of a 210? Are you all in? You all done at 200?
Just before Christmas, the Bush administration sold 116 parcels in southern Utah. Environmental groups challenged 77 of them in court. And yesterday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced he was rejecting those controversial bids.
President Obama and I believe strongly that we need to responsibly develop our oil and gas supplies to help reduce our dependence on foreign oil. But we need to make sure that we protect our signature landscapes and cultural resources for future generations.
The canceled parcels cover 130,000 acres. Some are near Arches and Canyonland National Parks. Kathleen Sagama represents the Independent Petroleum Association of America.
We're wondering why the administration is implementing policies that will limit economic development in the West, decrease our energy security, and make addressing climate change even more difficult.
Sharon Buccino, a lawyer for Natural Resources Defense Council, applauded the decision.
The beauty and the solitude that you gather from these wild lands is irreplaceable, and it's simply not worth the minuscule amount of oil and gas that's there.
Salazar left open the possibility that these parcels may be offered for lease again after the Obama administration assesses them. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
A Senate committee has laid out sweeping principles it will use to work on global warming legislation this year. The aim is to control greenhouse gases. At the same time, lawmakers are looking to create jobs and keep the U.S. economy competitive. There's no question it's a tall order. There are questions as to whether it's the right framework for addressing climate change. NPR's Richard Harris spoke to one academic who argues for a different approach.
Dan Sarewitz is an unassuming, slightly rumpled scientist who works out of an unassuming, slightly scruffy office in Washington, D.C. He runs an outfit called the Consortium for Science Policy and Outcomes, based at Arizona State University. And he's trying to figure out a better way to change the way the world uses energy.
This is really the metabolism of modern industrial society, our use of energy. And changing that system is not about replacing a few technologies or advancing our level of efficiency along certain fronts.
It means creating a whole new basis for the global economy. Sarewitz is skeptical that politicians can deliberately manage a transformation of that scale, either through legislation or through climate treaties. He says, for starters, measures that will ultimately force everyone to pay more for energy are doomed, both economically and politically.
Politically, what you're asking people to do is to pay a huge upfront cost for benefits many decades down the road that they can't even anticipate or predict. And that is politically an extremely difficult sort of situation to manage.
Harder still, considering that Americans rank global warming at the bottom of their worry list, according to a January poll by the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. And even if the public became passionate about climate change, Sarewitz says it's hard to imagine how they would warm to the idea of making carbon-emitting fuels prohibitively expensive. Just try to imagine how much that would cost.
The economic dislocation that would be created by getting to that sort of level would absolutely be immense. And it's easy to be casual about that, or it's easy to pin that kind of argument on conservative Republicans or on the executives of oil corporations. But nevertheless, it is absolutely true that you would be talking about something that would be completely destabilizing to global economies.
Okay, enough of the bad news. Sarewitz isn't a naysayer or a cynic, but he has been trying to think of another way to deal with climate change. To do that, he's looked back in history to see how we managed other major transformations. One example is agriculture. The United States government created a highly successful century-long effort to make food more abundant and affordable.
And it didn't do so by setting any particular target or timetable. It did so by investing in research, in development, and in very importantly, in institutions.
For example, the Agricultural Extension Service, which brought together researchers to tackle the big problems and farmers to put the solutions to work quickly. The key to all of it was speeding up innovation. And the good news is none of this required an ugly political or public debate. That's the model Sarah Woods would like to use for climate change.
The idea really is to take the political heat off of climate change and instead move this into the realm of policy wonkdom, where many, many small decisions made across many agencies, many types of policies, many domains, set the conditions for moving in the right direction without demanding that people accept that this is the most important problem in the world.
Sarowitz is now hard at work trying to identify what institutions we need to drive that transformation in the coming decades. The ultimate goal is to make renewable energy about as cheap as fossil fuels. Otherwise, there's little hope that the nations of the world will agree to tackle climate change. Sarowitz knows the Obama administration won't abandon its current path to craft climate laws and a treaty.
But there's no reason why they can't at the same time, and I'm hopeful that they will at the same time, understand that the real action is going to be on the innovation front.
And, he adds, there's no time to lose. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. The economic stimulus package moving through Congress includes billions of dollars for dealing with climate change. The legislation has a huge pile of money to make homes and buildings more energy efficient, and there's more money to subsidize renewable energy. But real progress on dealing with climate change is estimated to cost trillions, not billions. And a sobering analysis shows even the world's most ambitious plans don't go far enough. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Far above and beyond the stimulus package, President Obama has set a goal of slashing our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% between now and the middle of the century. What that could cost is anybody's guess. But if you want to know what that means in terms of the climate, ask Robert Carell. He's a scientist at the nonprofit Heinz Center in Washington, D.C. That's part of a group of academics, corporations, nonprofits, and others who have banded together as the Climate Action Initiative. One item in their bag of tricks is a computer program that simulates the climate on a laptop.
And it produces results in about a second.
Want to know how fast the world will heat up and how fast sea levels will rise under any given emissions control scenario? Just ask the computer.
This runs in the PC world, and I'm a Mac guy, so I'm having... There we are. All right.
While you need a supercomputer to give you a full-blown simulation of the climate, this nimble program, developed at MIT and the University of Pennsylvania, is designed to give the Cliff Notes version with good accuracy. And Carell can sit down with environment ministers or even heads of state to show them a glimpse of the future to guide their decisions. So, for example, Carell showed us what would happen if the 15 nations in the world with the most emissions were all able to meet their huge aspirational goals for the year 2050. Those goals range from an 80% reduction on the part of the United States and Europe to slower emissions growth rates for China. A few clicks later, here's the answer.
It gets you a planet that's probably 4 to 6 degrees warmer than it is now.
Centigrade or Fahrenheit?
That's centigrade.
So double that for Fahrenheit.
Roughly doubling that for... So
when you talk about a goal of 80% reduction by 2050, I think people generally feel pretty good about that. They feel it's highly ambitious, but if we can accomplish that, I think people assume that problem solved. You're saying not so.
Absolutely not so.
So then we turned the question around to ask what would solve the problem. Many scientists say that the amount of carbon dioxide in the air should be no more than 400 parts per million. That's already a big increase over pre-industrial levels and portends several degrees of temperature rise, but it's much less likely to have catastrophic consequences. So how do you get there?
There are probably many, many ways to do it.
Carell has one example. The 8 leading industrialized countries would need to take on much more ambitious plans than they have today. And the 5 rapidly industrialized nations, including China and India, would have to join in.
Here's what you find. It takes about a 5% reduction per year by the developed and the other 5 countries, China and India, and a reduction or maybe even just stabilization of the rest of the world. 5% per year is huge.
As just one point of comparison, California has one of the most ambitious greenhouse gas control plans in the nation, and emissions there are still going up, not down. Correll says it would require global investments of tens of trillions of dollars in the coming decades. And we don't just need to spend the money ourselves. We need to convince China and India to follow suit. If this sounds more than daunting, well, that's the point.
This is sort of a wake-up call mechanism. Oh, it's tougher than I thought. And I probably have to think about it differently.
One person pushing for an intellectual paradigm shift is Dan Sarewitz from Arizona State University. It's his view that simply forcing the world to stop using cheap and abundant fossil fuels could never happen because it would completely destabilize the global economy. The problem may sound hopeless, but
that does not lead automatically into an abyss of depression or resignation that we can't do anything about it. It leads me to turn to what we understand about how to stimulate successful innovation.
Sarewitz argues that our only hope is to invent our way out of this problem. That's a story for tomorrow. Richard Harris, NPR News.
When old TVs and computers end up in landfills or incinerators, the heavy metals and flame retardants they contain can cause pollution. States have been looking for solutions to this e-waste problem, and Washington State has come up with one. It now requires manufacturers to pay the entire cost of recycling computers and TVs. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Ann Dornfeld reports.
Remember that laptop you took such good care of for years? Well, today a guy in a warehouse is bashing it apart with a hammer. If the first step in the computer recycling process was hard to listen to, you might want to cover your ears for a few seconds as the guts of your computer are pulled out piece by piece. Each goes into a separate chute, then into a gigantic Cuisinart. And your computer has been turned into confetti. As confetti goes, it's pretty valuable. There are precious metals in the circuit boards. The steel and aluminum will be sold to refineries and smelters, too. Still, the Environmental Protection Agency says in 2007, more than 80% of all old computers, monitors, and TVs ended up in the trash.
These kinds of materials all need to be safely managed.
Miles Kuntz manages the electronics recycling program for the Washington State Department of Ecology.
Well, the cathode ray tubes contain 4 to 8 pounds of lead, depending on the size of the tube. There's also mercury, there's cadmium, and PBDEs, which are flame retardants.
Some states have made it illegal to throw e-waste in the trash. Others sponsor e-waste recycling programs. But these programs are expensive, and the cost is expected to spike this year as people get rid of their old analog TVs for the digital conversion. Now Washington State thinks it has the solution. Starting this year, every manufacturer that sells TVs, computers, or monitors there must pay for all residential recycling of those products. The state's working with the manufacturers to create a network of drop-off centers from recycling facilities to thrift stores. Miles Kuhn says at first, a lot of manufacturers weren't too happy.
So the idea that Sony, Apple, and all the other smaller manufacturers as well had to register with Washington, pay an administrative fee to the state of Washington, and then get ready to pay for recycling, that was a real hard pill for them to swallow. But they've come around to the fact that that is a new business cost.
That new business cost is known as producer responsibility, holding manufacturers accountable for the full life cycle of their products. Sarah Westervelt heralds the new law. She's a coordinator with the nonprofit Basel Action Network, which works to keep toxic waste out of the environment.
The notion is that if a manufacturer has to pay for the end-of-life costs, the recycling costs for their products, that they will have an economic incentive to redesign them so there are no toxins in them or fewer toxins in them, and so they are more easily broken down and recycled, and maybe so that they even last longer.
Douglas Smith directs corporate environmental affairs for Sony Electronics. He says it doesn't work that way.
We redesign products because of what our customers want, and we see this as a global requirement. But the state regulation itself doesn't have that result.
Still, Smith says Sony will comply with Washington's new law, as well as other smaller-scale recycling laws that have popped up in other states. He says what Sony would like to see, though, is one federal producer responsibility law for electronics recycling so manufacturers don't have to juggle different state requirements. For NPR News, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Seattle.